Welcome to episode 5 of Teaching to Meet the Moment from the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching here at Stanford University's Graduate School of Education. I'm Mike Hines.
And I'm Nicole Aluciani Elliott.
In today's episode, we're talking about strategies to make the most of asynchronous and synchronous learning in our classrooms. So, Nicole, asynchronous and synchronous learning are terms that many of us, I think, even as educators, might have been unfamiliar with, or we maybe have just started thinking about them in a robust way in this last year or so as we transition to hybrid or remote instruction. So I'm wondering, from your work at CSET, could you maybe start us off by just giving us a definition of asynchronous and synchronous learning?
Sure. I'll say from the outset, like I feel like we say almost every week, I don't intend to be an expert here. In fact, our guests are going to be far more expert at this than I am. But I will offer that our working definition is basically synchronous is what's done with the teacher and asynchronous is done what's without the teacher. And sometimes people mistakenly think these words are just jargon. Like, why can't we just say classwork and homework? Why do we have to use these fancy words? And the reason we choose not to say those things is that really classwork and homework is an oversimplification of what we do as teachers in designing arcs of learning. Traditionally, for better or worse, homework is usually a preview of the next day's lesson or a review of the day before's lesson, or maybe it's some kind of practice or project that serves to tell the teacher what you learned. While asynchronous work can certainly be all those things, it's actually more nuanced, especially as it relates to distance learning. And that's because some of our teachers only see our kids once a week, online, or maybe sometimes they see them more often, but they're not allowed to use breakout rooms for group work. Everyone is teaching in a different context right now, and there's really no formula, even if you believed in the notion of having a formula before this. So we have to design an arc of learning that's incredibly intentional. We ask ourselves what really does need to be taught by the teacher. What learning is best done offline, alone, in groups? How can I design the learning that is happening without me in a way that supports all of my students? How can I design it so that one thing builds on the next thing? What story am I trying to tell with this lesson? And how am I reinforcing the skills and knowledge needed? So it really comes down to the learning and not the doing. How am I designing the learning? What parts can I do alone or with other students? And that's the asynchronous learning.
Okay, so I think I'm starting to get it, right? It is about more about the learning than the doing or the practicing. And I think that's a really important distinction to make. I mean, you know, traditionally going back hundreds of years, learning was mostly limited to what happened in the classroom, right? In front of the watchful eyes of your instructor, whether that's a lecture or a recitation or work that's done at the board or something else. And then your practice, right, the doing in the form of homework could happen outside the classroom, but little more than that was really expected or required. But, right, pedagogy and technology have evolved. And if we shift our mindset and really start thinking about how to engage our students in learning, both asynchronously and synchronously, we can really expand when and where and how learning takes place. So, you know, with that as background, I think all of us, right, from college instructors to pre-K and early childhood folks, are thinking a lot more about how to incorporate asynchronous and synchronous elements into our teaching. And thankfully, our 4 guests today are expert educators, and they represent a real range of grade levels and disciplines, and each has experience navigating this terrain. So we're going to let them introduce themselves, starting with our own Christine Bywater.
Hey, y'all. I am honored to be a guest this week on the podcast. I work at CSET as a professional development associate, both in the areas of history education, educational technology. My primary work focuses on supporting teachers in developing digital pedagogies that foster learning environments for students that center joy and creativity. I also am the co-instructor for the computational thinking course at Stanford's Graduate School of Education. And prior to all this work at Stanford, I was a high school social studies teacher in Brooklyn and have worked for Apple in supporting youth and teacher professional development programs.
Christine, we're really, really lucky to have you. And we're really excited that you're stepping out from behind the scenes and you're going to be talking to us today. Next, we want to introduce Chris Deere.
Hi, y'all. I'm super grateful to be here. My name is Chris Deere, and I'm a history teacher and author from New Orleans. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Chris. Next, we have Arturo Lazaro Jr.
Good evening, and thank you all for having me here. I'm in my 10th year teaching. I currently teach at Mesa Charter High School in Brooklyn, and I've just been able to teach all over New York City. And outside of New York City in China. Thank you again for having me here.
Last but not least, we have Jen Price.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jen, and I've been teaching for 14 years, currently in kindergarten. I've dabbled in some curriculum development as well as some staff training. I have my master's in leadership and teaching and plan to eventually move into school leadership. I also channeled some of my pandemic anxiety into writing and illustrating a children's book this past fall, and I'm super thankful to be here as well.
Jen, what's the name of your book?
It is called not a self-promotion here, guys. Mask Up.
No, I love.
It's called Mask Up: A COVID Crusader Story. So it's teaching our little ones about the importance of wearing our mask.
Good for you. That's amazing.
All right. So welcome to all of our guests. We've got these extraordinary educators here. And our first question is really just kind of a basic question, but I have a sense can be pretty complex in your explanation. How were you all approaching the planning or structuring of your lessons before the shift to remote instruction? And what about that approach has shifted or changed now that you're in remote? So I'd like to start with Jen, and then we can move on to Arturo after that.
So I think the biggest thing that has changed for me as an early childhood teacher is before, when we were teaching in person, we had the luxury of time. We had all the time throughout the entire week to, you know, look out for those teachable moments, for that spontaneous learning that happens when you're with kids. And now I think the biggest shift is taking the biggest things that we need to teach our kids to prepare them for everything that's coming and funnel that down. So I'm giving them the biggest bang for their buck as I think of it. So I think that's one of the things that's been the biggest shift with only having a fraction of the time that we had before.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Arturo, tell us about your experience, because you've got a little background in remote learning. I'm wondering how you might have thought about this a little bit differently.
Yeah, I started remote learning back in March when the pandemic first started, and we've been remote since at our school. Before the pandemic, I think my class was centered around classroom discussion, right? Coming in, being able to discuss error analysis and whatnot. But during the pandemic, it's a little bit difficult. I know that we mentioned breakout rooms, and I don't know about you all, but in breakout rooms, sometimes students just don't talk, right? They're just muted. And so I had to kind of like, you know, go back and with some people brainstorm about how can we combat this? And we figured out some ways, asking students for preferences on who they would prefer to work with. And we've had results there. But I think we also have tried, I teach stats. So we stripped down some of the material, and just try to focus on what's essential for them to know in a college level course or what they need to know outside of high school, such as working with spreadsheets, and just try to make, content more relevant to them.
Mm-hmm. We're going to dig back into some of the other things that you've done in a minute. I want to get over to Chris. Part of why I love this panel, not only are we K-12, we're also coast to coast and down to the south. So, Chris, tell us what's happened in New Orleans as far as remote learning. How have you made shifts from the way you ran your classroom before to how you're doing it now?
I would say my biggest shifts, also with Jen is time. Time is a massive issue. but more so technology. Prior to the pandemic, I wasn't really creating virtual materials for students. A lot of students didn't have the internet, didn't have Chromebooks, or if they did, they were sharing it with their siblings and whatnot. So essentially having to craft lessons almost from scratch and make them virtual has been a challenge. And to reiterate what Arturo said, getting student feedback is essential. So that was something I was definitely doing prior to the pandemic, but now it's almost every day. It's trying to seek constant feedback from students, because some things we think will work don't. And then some things we don't think work, apparently they do. And students are very happy and receptive to let us know what works and what doesn't. So I would say the shift to technology would probably be the biggest change for me.
Mm-hmm. This is really making me think. In a couple of episodes, Mike and I are going to lead a conversation about surprise affordances and what we're learning that we're actually going to continue to do when we all go back to school. Because I think there's some things here that just the three of you have mentioned: being more thoughtful about time, making sure you solicit feedback, keeping the content very relevant. These are things that we've been forced to learn, but that actually maybe we should have learned quite a while ago. I'm going to follow back around and kind of do a backwards circle, starting with Chris, with this next question of really thinking specifically about synchronous and asynchronous learning. How does this fit into your decision making? And maybe first start with how often you see our students, because I think that makes a big difference. But how are you thinking about what you need to be there for? And then how are you thinking about what they do when they're on their own?
Sure. So right now I'm teaching 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and it's 60 minutes. And then on Tuesdays and Thursdays, it's asynchronous. The students are on their own. So with that in mind, there are some benefits to asynchronous learning. I know it seems really tough, but students can work at their own pace. And that's crucial. A lot of students are essential workers. They work in grocery stores, fast food places, millions of them. So that is one benefit that students can actually take with them and do. In terms of trying to provide content for students during asynchronous learning and getting them engaged, I make videos, content videos for students to watch, and they can rewind, go back and forth, pause it, watch it on their own time. But a lot of students have said that the videos can be rather lengthy for them to kind of sit there and consume 10 minutes at a time. Mm-hmm. So one recent change that I made within the last 2 weeks is I've been putting a lot of history content on TikTok, and students seem to have really appreciated that little 1 minute history segment. So that's one change that I've made recently.
Thank you. Thank you. Arturo, how are you thinking about synchronous versus asynchronous?
Yeah, I the way that I think about it, or the way that I approach it, is I see my students two times on a given week, and I won't see them again for, I see them, sorry, two times every 2 weeks for 90 minutes each lesson. So I don't see them as often as I would like. However, that just allows me to think of creative ways to think about asynchronous learning. So for me, I think our kids, as Chris mentioned, are working, right? Like they're there, but they also have responsibilities and, you know, when they're learning. So I feel, based on my students' feedback, I'm giving them only like Khan Academy videos. I've tried creating my own videos and having them like ask for feedback or asking for feedback, like, do you prefer me to create videos, or do you prefer Sal from Khan Academy? you know, but also I've been providing students with notes as well, so they can work at their own place. And I think as a teacher, we also have to be flexible with due dates. And so I've been very flexible with that. And in terms of synchronous learning, the way that I have it is I miss circulating around the classroom. So my way of doing that is by using a Pear Deck. Mm-hmm. And with that, I'm able to facilitate a little bit of conversation there by showing students their work and having other peers comment on that.
Great. Thank you. Jen, tell us what's happening in the world of kinder. How often do you see our little ones?
Yeah, so my kids are the kids of all of the essential workers that we've got. So We, at my campus, we've split our synchronous time with our exploratory teachers. So our art teacher sees our kids my kids in particular on Mondays and Wednesdays. And then I have my kids on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays coming up soon. And so when I have my kids for that synchronous time, I really try to get in as much of the grade level content as I can, just so it's that exposure that they need during our whole group instruction. And then in our small group instruction, that very targeted instruction for, you know, what the kids need specifically. And similarly, I'm doing for our asynchronous, we're doing videos. My colleagues are on my grade level team are amazing. We've named collaboration the word of the year. So we split up the content areas, which has really helped and I think has benefited the students and the families. So for example, I create the reading lesson videos. One of my colleagues creates the math lessons and one of them creates the writing lessons. And so through that, we're able to get out that grade level content. The families are able to watch it at their own time, you know, given the huge variety of schedules that they've got going on. So yeah, one of the things that's really worked for us is that flexibility with the families, like Arturo mentioned, just, you know, you have this week, you have next week. We understand that there's such a variety of things going on in everybody's lives. So flexibility and collaboration have definitely been the name of the game this year.
You know, elementary school teachers do that collaboration thing so beautifully. I don't think we're as good at it at the secondary level. You guys, if you could each take a unit, everybody who teaches your course, and really kind of split up and share, like that, I think that's genius. Thanks, Jen.
Guys, thanks for those answers. I mean, I love how sort of specific everybody's being about their thinking and about their approach here. And I want to jump in with another question, which is, you know, this is such a new process for both us as instructors and for our students. And it can be difficult, right? So I want to know about what are the structures or what are the supports that you found you need to put in place to support synchronous and asynchronous learning, right? You know, Christine, I want to start with you on this one because I did some homework. I read a really wonderful piece where you were being interviewed by some other faculty here at Stanford. And you're talking about launch pads and flip grids and jam boards and all this sort of stuff that sort of undergirds and helps build a platform for students to be able to engage synchronously and asynchronously. So I wondered if maybe you could start by taking us through some of that.
Sure. I'll actually start by saying one of my core beliefs generally, and I think I'm holding stronger to in this virtual setting, is that remote learning doesn't mean digital experiences all the time. And one of the things I've really tried to center is how do we take our pedagogical core around community, around getting to know each other, around understanding how we think and feel, how movement plays into our instruction, and how do I bring that into a virtual setting for students? And one of the ways to help facilitate that is organization. I will also name, I am a very loud type A personality. So organization is also my crutch. I overdo it when I want to make up for something. But we facilitate these experiences by helping students know where exactly do I need to be. So we use something called a launch pad, which is pretty much a fancy Google Doc that supports students in knowing what are the questions I'm being asked of today? What are the questions I'm going to be asked of when we're thinking about our readings? What are the experiences and reflections I should be doing outside of class? How am I thinking about what I'm seeing? And with that, sort of supporting them in understanding what activities we'll be doing synchronously and what we'll be doing asynchronously. So it's very clear the pathway and the expectations.
Awesome. Chris, could you jump in on this question as well?
Absolutely. Well, in terms of support and students with synchronous and asynchronous learning, Nicole was actually my coach for 2 years. So she supported me with synchronous and asynchronous learning and helped me become a much better teacher. So I do have to give you that shout out, Nicole. But to reiterate what Kristen is saying is organization is key. At the very least, learning during the pandemic may be chaotic, but at the very least, students will know what's transpiring in class. There, I have a calendar where students that I can share with anybody where students know the exact objective, the theme of the class, the questions, the agenda. And on top of organization, I would say communication is key. So I always try to ensure that these lines of communication are always open for students and that they know, as Arturo said earlier, if they need an extension, if they need any assistance, that we're there for them. And that is crucial for students to know that, you know, what's going on, and also that we're there in case they need us in any way, shape, or form.
Jen, how does that sort of scaffolding, or how does that building support look in your work?
It's very similar. Organization and consistency, I think, are crucial for not only the kids, but the families too. I use a parent-facing distance learning plan, which is basically a table with all of the links for every day and all of the assignments, so that they have an idea of what their kiddos are doing. But then we use a student-facing platform called Seesaw that the students are able to access videos, access any of the learning plan aspects that we're sharing with them, and then they can submit their work for that as well. So, and I think just having a consistent schedule for them has been one of the structures that's been really, really helpful throughout all of this.
And Arturo.
Yeah. So, listening to all of you all, and I'm like, I think I need to reflect on my organizational skills with these kids. I think for me, the structures that I need to have is I need to be able to see what students are doing. So that's why I'm sticking to like Pear Deck, right? That's like a life changer right now. But I also think I need to provide students with the resources. So on their Google Classroom, at least for my AP class, there's a study guide for them that's being updated weekly. So that way they can use that in case they missed the lesson, but also for each worksheet that they receive, they also receive notes in case they missed out because they need to take care of a sibling or they just need to cook, you know, like it happens. So I think having those structures in place or having those resources in place have helped out my students. And as Chris mentioned, yeah, being flexible. Sometimes like I have an open door policy or open virtual room policy in here. And sometimes I have to stay up after school to help out a student who missed out. And that's okay. I'm okay with that. So just being able to be flexible with them.
I'll definitely, you know, chime in even, you know, in my own work working with master's students and PhD students. Organization helps a ton. I thought maybe it would be different, but I don't know why. And my students love, you know, knowing exactly where they can go, you know, in Canvas under this module. I now have modules set up for every week, right? With the resources, the readings, the link to the Zoom, for the class session, right? I've started sending students the questions that we're going to be talking about in discussions, a few days before the class so that they can start to preview the material. You know, and started to use announcements to start to send videos and clips and, you know, exit tickets and links to supplementary readings. So I really, you know, what you guys are saying about consistency and about organization really resonates with me, just in the work that I'm doing too. So it feels good to hear that from other instructors too.
Can I jump in and just add a thought here? Prompted by, there's a question in the chat from our faculty director, Janet Carlson, about content, which I think would be a good one for you all to weigh in on. And it also has me thinking a lot about this notion of narrative, right? So Chris and I worked together, as he said, for 2 years. And when you're teaching history, the awareness of the narratives that you're teaching, it's critical for kids to be able to tell the story at the end. What did they learn, right? History, the word story is literally there. There's also a narrative to a math unit. There's a narrative to a reading lesson, right? What's the story that we're trying to tell? And how do we know that the child has learned that story or made meaning in their own meaning of that story? Part of that is the question of content. So part A of my question is, what are you choosing to keep and what are you choosing to let go of from your content? Because we can't get it all in. We couldn't get it all in even when we were in person. So how are you making those hard questions, you know, intentional choices? The second part is really my question around, and I'll ask that of Jen and Chris too. So what content questions or choices are you making and how are you making those? And secondly, how is your asynchronous instruction or your asynchronous lessons linking your synchronous lessons so you don't lose momentum for the learning? Jen, let's start with you and then we'll head to Chris and then Arturo.
So I think, like we talked about, I think because we don't have that luxury of time, you're absolutely right. There's so much of the kindergarten curriculum that I've been, you know, tinkering with and editing along the way for a million years, it feels like at this point. So much of that has to be stripped away. And I think we might touch on this a little bit later on, but I think one of the benefits, because we're in a pandemic, right, of virtual learning is that I think for me, I'm stripping away the extra stuff that, yeah, sometimes it's like the fun stuff that the kids really love. But I think as far as content, I'm trying to teach in a way that I'm using an economy of language, so to speak. So I'm giving them the most basic foundation, especially, you know, as early childhood students. So I'm giving them the foundation of what they need so that way they can be successful next year when they move on to first grade. So I think for me, that's one way to address that and one way that I've been thinking about that. And then as far as linking my asynchronous work to my synchronous, I teach in a project-based learning style. So it sort of just threads its way through whether we're doing synchronous or asynchronous. So it has a pretty direct tie last semester we did a project and we, you know, whatever we were talking about in our whole group or in our small groups, it was tied to the writing that they were producing to put on Seesaw for their asynchronous work, for example. So tying those through a project lens, I think, is one of the ways that's been successful.
It's a great idea. It's a great idea. Christine, let's go to you next because we've got kinder with Jen and we've got adults with you. And I'm curious, then we'll talk to to Chris and Arturo about the kind of middle of the road high school kids. But I'm curious because you're having to make the same decisions. Mm-hmm. So take us through your process.
Yeah, what was interesting as I listened to Jen is I think with the older students, we've done the opposite, where I'm centering creativity and pushing for more hands-on experiences for them to process how they're feeling and get to know each other. And part of that is that my pedagogy will always drive what I'm teaching, but no one's going to learn anything unless they get to know each other. So we create experiences in person that allow the student to find out what are their interests? What experiences and background knowledge am I bringing to this space? And then when we do asynchronous activities that are also hands-on, we have them post videos on Flipgrid, having them not tell me what they know, but what they think. How was that experience for you? What did you think about as you approached that? And then they talk with a partner and then they tell us what they learned about that partner. So in organizing these thinking routines and structures, we're centering the content and I'm centering my pedagogy, but I'm supporting the students in making sure that we're connecting with each other, even though it's virtually. It's like everyone said, you know, we're in a pandemic. Like if we come out of this knowing all the content in the world, that's not going to matter. Like we need to make sure we're okay as people. And so that's really was at the center of what drives how I structure those experiences.
Thank you for that.
If I could jump in, I want to turn this question about the pacing and the content to Chris and to Arturo. But I noticed in the chat we had a question about how do you do that specifically as teachers who are teaching AP classes, mm-hmm. right? classes that have been, you know, traditionally structured around getting a lot of information in, right, to prepare for those exams with limited amount of time for students. So I wondered if, you know, Chris and then Arturo could answer, you know, what they're feeling around pacing, but also, you know, speak to the experience of teaching AP classes.
Well, in terms of teaching AP, pacing has always been an issue, even before the pandemic. But in terms of what to keep and what to take away, because I'm only teaching 3 days a week, 60 minutes a day. And so my time has been, you know, significantly cut. But I think any history class needs to emphasize and focus on the human aspect of what transpired. How did the events actually impact the people? How did the American Revolution impact indigenous nations in the West, as opposed to memorizing dates and facts and statistics of what the exact year was of the Battle of Saratoga. So in my class, that's something I definitely want to emphasize on, regardless of how much time I have. For instance, yesterday we just had a debate, what impacted the United States more, the American Revolution or the Market Revolution, in terms of how it impacted people. And through those conversations, hopefully they're gaining that content that they need for AP classes. And every class has a theme, so I try to connect these themes to the next class. And throughout the year, hopefully that theme is, these themes are well established and firm in their mind.
You keep coming back to the same sorts of themes and students can see them again and again, right?
Change in continuity and whatnot. Yeah. Exactly.
Absolutely. Arturo, I saw you nodding along too. Can you build off that?
Yeah, I just like Chris, like the pacing even before this was, I felt like almost impossible to keep up. And with remote learning, I have to be honest, it's still difficult. It's even more difficult. I try to condense some of the information, but I don't know. I'm at a crossroads. But the way that I try to combat this is through discussions. I used to feel pressure about the exam and try to meet certain deadlines, but I think I just want them to leave out of the classroom being curious about learning and being able to have accountable talks with their peers when they leave my classroom and go to college. And so maybe I'm giving up some of the material, and maybe in the next few months, maybe we'll have to do some sort of, like, I don't know, Saturday program, or maybe figure something out in the school that would allow them to get more practice, more at-bats at the AP. But it's hard. It's hard. But also, I do want to say that I am flexible. So I will hold classes or small office hours at like 4:30. Or 5:30 until like 7 or 8. And yeah, we're trying, but it's hard. It's hard.
Well, something I keep hearing, I think, from all of you in one way or another, are that our goals as educators are shifting, right? That we're prioritizing our students. We're prioritizing their well-being. We're deprioritizing getting the sort of wide coverage of a lot of material, right? We're trying to make the classroom content more relevant. We're trying to build community. I think along those same lines, I definitely want to ask, how does equity and social justice guide or inform, your thinking when it comes to synchronous or asynchronous learning, right? Because we know that technology is a tool, but it's about how you use it, right? So how are you guys employing technology in ways that make classrooms more equitable and more just for our students, right? And, you know, I think maybe we should start with Jen, and then maybe get Christine back into the conversation as well.
Yeah, so I think even access to technology is a social justice issue. My school, we really have an equity lens. And so we worked really hard to make sure that the students who needed an iPad or a Chromebook, that they had access to that. We worked hard to make sure that families who didn't have internet access, that they had a hotspot. So even just at the base level of, you can't get to Zoom, you can't get on Seesaw if you don't have any devices, or if you don't have, you know, internet that'll stay on long enough that you can get on Zoom. So we really tackled that. Back in March, we started addressing that right away. But thinking down those lines, a lot of my students have families who are working, or have families who there's one parent and there's many kids. There's, you know, like I was saying earlier, there's lots of situations with families. And I think our youngest kiddos are the ones that need the most support. So one of the things that I've been really having my eye on this year is just how can I support the kids who don't get that support at home? And so I've been doing that, really, again, just being flexible with the families. You know, there, I don't have a hard, fast deadline for when XYZ is due. I try to create a list of things and assignments that will give me a better idea of their learning versus things that are just more optional. So we're working with families in that sense. And the same for attendance. I realize that not all families can get their kid onto Zoom every day. And, you know, on the days that we have our small groups, the kids are jumping on online, you know, 2 to 3 times a day. So I think just being flexible and keeping an eye on those families who just need a little bit of extra support from me as a teacher and from our school community.
I want to jump to Christine. How are you thinking about that issue of social justice and equity mm-hmm. in how you're, you know, designing and carrying out lessons?
Yeah, so I'll say, when we think about equitable instruction, the sustained relationships, bringing in student interests and cultures, that still remains at the core. If I'm not doing those things in the classroom, technology isn't going to magically make those happen. I have to then be able to do those things through the use of the technology. And so to be an equitable instructor in terms of my digital practices, I need to find technology that liberates students and it gives them the freedom of choice to express their interests, to express their cultures, to express their understanding in the setting, and not rely on the technology to be a barrier that could just perpetuate these inequities that we've seen and we know exist already. So that is a lot of intentional choices on my part about how I'm selecting the tools, but also what structures am I giving the students to select the tools? Because what I care most is how they're bringing their whole selves into our community.
Chris, and then we'll go to Arturo.
Yeah, to build off on both of what Jen and Christine said, in terms of technology, that was certainly an issue. But one issue that I didn't anticipate until more recently is students maintaining the technology that they were given, whether they received a Chromebook in March of 2020 that was used and years old, and now that Chromebook is out of space, or it's not working, or the backspace key is missing. So as Arturo said, I try to hold office hours to help students with issues like that, which is something I never thought I'd be kind of working in a tech kind of space, but here we are, right? Another way I feel in terms of equity is, as teachers, we can always affirm students. We can affirm their identities, their opinions, their beliefs, their experiences and backgrounds. And fortunately, as a history teacher, I can also validate students through the content that I teach and constantly bring in their history to the forefront. So, helping students with technology, which is something we do every day. And I'm sure all teachers are doing that. And then trying to affirm students, whether it's, you know, telling them or showing them through your curriculum.
Mm-hmm. And Arturo.
Yeah, I just wanted to emphasize, like, I think we wear multiple hats here, including what Chris mentioned, at IT support or tech support in our classrooms. But for me, I think just having that flexibility to that open line of communication with the students, because sometimes they might be in the classroom, but not really. But for me though, it comes with a caveat, and that's that it can be exhausting. And I think it's because we never leave our virtual classroom. And so, what I try to do then is, for the students, at least when it comes to asynchronous, is to limit the videos or homework to about 20 minutes for both AP and non-AP courses. just so that way they can, I don't know, have some time to breathe, because I don't feel like as teachers we breathe, and I can imagine the students who have multiple courses that they're taking. But I also want them to feel like they're a part of the classroom, right? It's not all about the content, but it's all about, like, do I feel like I belong in this classroom? And so for me, it's all about establishing that relationship with the students. And that's very key in having some sort of success with the remote learnings, that we've done so far.
Right. So I've heard you guys talk about some of the challenges. I've heard some of the benefits come out. I think, you know, to sort of wrap us up today, I just want to maybe go through and hear one or two things, that you think you will take back, you know, after this is over, as we move, you know, hopefully in the near future to being back in the same buildings, in the same rooms with our students. What are some of the things that you will take from this experience, and what are the sort of frames of mind or ways of framing your work that you're going to take back? So Arturo, if you could start us off, and then we'll go back around.
Sure. So one thing that I would take back once we get into like the regular classroom setting would be the use of Pear Deck or the use of Edpuzzle. And the reason why is because I want to start the flipped classroom model in my classroom. Mm-hmm. And so I want to foster discussion, but I want students to come in prepared. And so for me, I feel like having that flipped classroom model is going to work. And with the practice that the students have had so far with technology and asking questions and us as teachers being able to embed questions in there, I think it's something that I would want to try. Once we get back into the normal setting, so continue using the technology, eventually to just have like a classroom discussion, 100% in my classroom.
It's really reimagining how you structure your classroom. Mm-hmm. Christine, what are you going to take back?
Yeah, what's interesting about what you said earlier, Mike, in terms of how we're all shifting our instruction and the things you named. I would argue should have been what was happening in the classroom in the first place. And I hope that those core values come back. Something that we've seen, at least in teaching the college students, is giving them more time to process. So instead of a 3-hour class, we've cut it down to 90 minutes, and then we're doing asynchronous activities, has actually led to a lot more creativity and conversation. So I think about what that might look like when we go back to in person, to not feel so restricted by the time, and to allow for opportunities even in the four walls for more processing that is quiet and maybe online that we can then connect as a group more holistically.
Jen?
I think one of the things that I've really enjoyed this year, or in the last year, is that the emphasis on collaboration, not only between my colleagues and I, but with the families. I think the families have stepped up in such an incredible way this last year. And not to say that families weren't involved prior to the pandemic, but they're involved on a much different level. And I think that families bring such rich experiences and perspectives to our classroom. And I would love for that to continue in some capacity as we slowly creep back into in-person.
Then Chris, we'll give you the last word.
Oh, that's a lot of pressure. I found myself nodding my head at everybody that was speaking. But I always said if we return to the status quo after this, then we haven't gained the necessary insight that we should have throughout this entire experience. But in terms of something concrete, I think one concrete aspect that I'm going to bring back is the idea of students being able to attend class via Zoom if they can't make it, whether they had a transportation issue or if they're out of town or visiting family or anything like that. Because I've had students this year visit class or attend class from a car or out of town, and I always thought that was really amazing. So if there's anything, that would be something I would take back. And I hope as a whole, we can continue to relax on standardized testing. I think that we've seen education still flourish, even if we relax on standardized testing a bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm so grateful for this time, y'all, because for a number of reasons, but mostly I think because We spend a lot of time feeling downtrodden and frustrated and complaining about how this pandemic has put a magnifying glass on so many things that are wrong with our system. Everything that was wrong before is now wrong times of 5,000. I would have stood up and shouted amen when you said, if we go back and don't change, then it was a waste. I really appreciate kind of the learning stance that you all have all taken on what can we learn about our craft when we're forced into this new circumstance. And I think what I'm taking away so much is around remembering our humanness and being intentional about joy and community and being intentional about families. We at the high school level don't do a good job with families. What could we be learning from the Jen Prices of the world about how to better incorporate our families when we're literally in their homes? These are all things I'm walking away from this conversation in a place of curiosity, as opposed to a place of, oh, damn, this is so hella hard. And you all have brought that for me. I also want to note, we have a guest in the chat, Awale, who has mentioned this balance of community and self-care and checking in with one another, along with academic excellence. If they don't have to be mutually exclusive. And sometimes we think, well, if I take care of a child's humanity, then I'm being soft on them academically. And I think that's absolute nonsense. So I appreciate the comments left in the chat. Thank you all so much for being here. Thanks to all of our guests and the audience today. In a couple of weeks, the podcast will be live on our website, and I look forward to you sharing that with your friends. Next week, we're going to talk about grading. Annie brought up the question in the chat about grading and how we navigate that in this particular time. And luckily, next week, we're going to be talking exactly about that very thing with some really extraordinary teachers who are thinking out of the box in a lot of ways about grading. So I think that's it, Mike.
No, that's it, guys. Join us next week. And until then, have a great week.
Thanks, everybody.